I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. Coming up, you know award-winning actress Glenn Close from her work in provocative movies like Fatal Attraction and Albert Nobbs. But behind the scenes, she's also become an outspoken advocate for mental health. We'll learn how mental illness has affected her own family in just a few minutes. But first, we want to talk politics. The Republican presidential primary is all but officially over. The general election is just months away, but that doesn't mean campaign season isn't in full swing. Several local primaries might have a big national impact. And we've got new information on the money race in the fight for the White House. Joining us to talk about all this is Ron Elving, NPR senior Washington editor. Also with us, NPR political correspondent Don Gagne. Gentlemen, welcome back to you both. Thanks for joining us.
Good to be with you, Michelle.
Ron Elving, I want to start with the latest fundraising numbers in the presidential race. Mitt Romney and the GOP raised a little more than $40 million in April, which is pretty close to what President Obama took in last month. What do you make of those numbers?
First of all, there's no surprise that there's going to be an enormous amount of money on both sides in this presidential election. All thoughts of having a publicly financed fall campaign, general election campaign for president, as we had for a number of years, for several decades, that's gone. Neither candidate went by that. Barack Obama decided not to take that money in 2008. And when Barack Obama decided not to, that was pretty much the end of it. So in April, we saw the president raised about $43 million. That's about on pace for what he's been doing. And we saw Mitt Romney and the Republicans raise almost as much, $40 million, in the first month that Mitt Romney was clearly and really pretty much acknowledged to be their nominee against Obama.
We're going to switch gears in a minute because we have Representative Sandy Adams with us, and she's going to talk about another issue that's been a big controversy on Capitol Hill. But before we hear from her, Don Gagne, the total that Ron was talking about doesn't include the money that the so-called super PACs are raising, and I wanted to ask how you think that's changing the money picture.
Well, it's I don't think we can overstate how it's changing the money picture. Of course, it's money that the candidates and campaigns have no control over and have no input into how it is spent, what the messages are. So it's kind of wild card money that's out there, wild card for everybody involved. But it certainly is part of the discussion, has to be part of the discussion when we look at it this year.
And is Congresswoman Adams with us?
Yes.
Okay, great. So I just want to thank Ron Elving, NPR senior Washington editor, and NPR political correspondent Don Gagne for being with us. I want to turn now and talk about a bill that's sparking some heated debate on Capitol Hill, even by today's supercharged standards. The House of Representatives voted to reauthorize something called the Violence Against Women Act yesterday. This is something that's received bipartisan support since it first passed in 1994. This time was different. It barely passed along partisan lines with a vote of 222 to 205. That's because the Senate version of the legislation had specific provisions that would offer protections to Native American women on reservations, immigrant women, and lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgender people. Those were stripped out of the House bill at the behest of Republican lawmakers. But a number of Republican women representatives are stepping forward, arguing that their version of the act does protect all women and that this issue is being inappropriately politicized. We wanted to talk more about this with Representative Sandy Adams. She's a Republican representing Florida's 24th district, which includes Daytona Beach, and she also has a very important personal connection to this issue. Welcome to the program, Congresswoman. Thank you so much for speaking with us.
Thank you for having me.
I would like to step aside from the politics for a minute, if that's possible, and just to ask you what it is about this bill that makes you feel that the House version is superior to the Senate version.
Well, I think that if you look at both versions, you see that we put in a lot more victim-oriented, victim-centered. We built upon what the Senate had, but we actually did a victim-centered piece of legislation. And we've heard there's been a lot of talk out there, and unfortunately it's to politicize an issue that should never have been politicized. I believe that we needed to reauthorize it. We didn't need to politicize it. And unfortunately that's what happened when it came out of the Senate, and it's what's been happening all along. And what we are saying is, the victims deserve better. Americans deserve better. We need to just move forward. Let's get this reauthorized. It has been an all-inclusive bill from the very beginning, since 94. It says all victims. And I think that needs to be impressed upon a lot of people, that it says all victims. A victim is a victim.
One of the interesting things about this debate is that there are a lot of emotional debates on Capitol Hill, but that this is one in which many people have called forward and brought forward personal stories that I think many people may have not expected. Earlier, we heard from Representative Gwen Moore. She's a Democrat. She talked about her personal experience with domestic violence. And you also have one, too. And I just wanted to ask, do you mind telling us briefly about that?
Well, I will tell you that at an early age, I quit high school and joined the Air Force at 17. I was married by 18, and I had a little beautiful little girl. Unfortunately for me, I married someone who turned out to be a violent alcoholic. And so that was my story, and it wasn't pretty, and it was a cycle of violence that he had learned from his family, his father. And so I just couldn't live in that environment with my daughter because I wasn't raised in that environment. So at her age 3, we left. We left with just our clothes. Mm. Left in the house, the car, the furniture, everything. But back then, you have to remember, whatever happened between a husband and a wife, people just said, well, that's between the husband and the wife. And that's what VAWA did. When VAWA was enacted in 94, it brought light to a very bad situation. It brought hope to a lot of people. And I, you know, as a law enforcement officer, I paid my way through the academy, worked during the day, went through the academy at night, became a law enforcement officer because I love being able to help people.
I just want to mention, if you don't mind, that you served for 17 years as a deputy sheriff in the Orange County Sheriff's Office. So you have a very interesting take on this, having been on both sides of this issue, both as a law enforcement officer and as a survivor yourself. I did want to mention again.
And also, as a law enforcement officer prior to VAWA's first enactment and post VAWA. So I've seen all levels of it. And that's why I'm so adamant and so passionate about not politicizing this issue.
Can I just get your response to one thing? As we mentioned, Representative Gwen Moore spoke with us earlier. She had spoken on the House floor about her experience with domestic violence, and she also cited her personal experience about why she supports the provisions that many Republicans oppose. I just want to play a short clip and just ask your take on it. Here it is.
These provisions were not thrown in there in order to make a political statement about Republicans. These provisions were put in as a result of best practices. People who have litigated these cases, people who have been advocates for these folk, they decided that these expansions were really important.
Could I just get your take on that?
Well, you know, we did not have, when we were in committee, they cited one paper. But they didn't cite the fact that in this research that they had, this data paper that they had done, this polling or whatever you wanted to call it, that only less than 7% of the respondents responded back. And the major complaint in the responses they received back was lack of data. And so what we're saying is let's not have a solution in search of a problem. What we need is to understand what the issues are. In the committee work, in the committee meeting, the anecdotal issues that were brought forward had really nothing to do with the actual legislation itself. It may have had something to do with maybe the law enforcement agency wasn't providing the assistance that they should have. Well, that's a law enforcement agency issue, and that's an officer issue. And to me, and I said it in committee, this is a 101 law enforcement training issue. You know, assault is an assault. It doesn't, you know, I never responded to a scene and said, oh, let me find out who you are first before I determine if there's an assault or not.
Could I ask you one question, though, that seems to have attracted a lot of attention? That's the question of the immigration status of the women involved. The provisions, the Senate provision would give victims the ability to petition for their own immigration status. And Democrats are opposing that, saying that it compromises the safety, potentially compromises the safety of immigrant women. I have heard on the other side that there are those who are concerned that this would open the door to fraud, to immigration fraud. Is that your concern?
It's current law right now. Self-petitioning is still current law. And the manager's amendment, we took into consideration the concerns that Those had about having a someone actually interview the alleged perpetrator. And so, you know, the concerns were raised, so we removed that part of the original piece of language that we had because we were listening. But the one thing I did point out to a lot of our groups, a lot of our domestic violence groups, and they, when I talked to them, because everybody wants to focus on the immigration side of this one issue, I said, which victim, if you have someone who is abusing their immigrant spouse or about to be spouse, and that spouse gets out of that relationship, they make it out safely, and there's no stopping the cycle of violence on the perpetrator, then which victim doesn't make it out? And everybody is focusing on we're trying to be anti-immigrant. No, I'm looking at the victims here. Then the new, you know, one victim gets out, but which victim doesn't make it out?
Finally,
and that's what I think we need to focus on, is stopping that cycle of violence.
And
if we have someone that's perpetuating that violence, who's attacking people, we need to make sure that we stop that.
Congresswoman, before we let you go, and I do appreciate your time. I understand that you're in the middle of voting, and so it's a very difficult schedule, so thank you for fitting us in. Before we let you go, I did want to mention that there are Republican groups who also oppose this version, like the Log Cabin Republicans. Do you think they just don't understand, have it wrong? What do you make of it? Or you still feel it's just election year politics?
Well, I think it's election year politics, and they've listened and heard that, you know, they're excluded, which is absolutely false. They are not excluded. This is an all-inclusive victims bill. And I think that needs to be repeated over and over again, because the politics has taken control of this, and it should never have.
Yes, ma'am.
This
thank you so much.
Legislation has always been a victim-centered bill. It will always remain a victim-centered bill.
Yes, ma'am.
And what we have to remember is you start listing the groups, eventually you're going to get to a point where you're excluding people.
I see.
Right now, we say all victims.
All right. Yes, ma'am. Thank you for joining us. We appreciate it. Congresswoman Sandy Adams represents Florida's 24th district. She's a Republican. She joined us from the House of Representatives studio. Congresswoman, thank you so much for taking the time to speak with us.
Thank you.
I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. Coming up, it's been almost a year since a devastating tornado hit Joplin, Missouri on Joplin High School's graduation day. This year, the school welcomes a special commencement speaker, President Obama. We'll check in with the principal of Joplin High School in just a few minutes. But first, to our Wisdom Watch conversation. That's the part of the program where we speak with those who've made a difference through their work. Today, we have with us one of our country's biggest names in theater, film, and television, Glenn Close. She went from the New York stage to big roles in Oscar-nominated films, including Fatal Attraction and Albert Nobbs. She's also known for her lead in the hit TV series Damages, where she plays the brilliant but cutthroat lawyer Patty Hughes. Here's Patty talking to a young attorney.
You are in this office to wait for instructions. You don't have license to think. You have jeopardized the only serious lead we still have. How could you be so stupid?
The new season of Damages is premiering this July, but when Glenn Close is not wowing audiences, she's devoting her time to a very important cause, mental illness. She's the co-founder of Bring Change to Mind. That's a nonprofit that aims to confront the stigma and discrimination associated with mental illness. And Glenn Close joins us now. Welcome. Thank you so much for speaking with us.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
Now, I'm hoping we can talk a little bit about your acting work, but before we do, I did want to talk about your advocacy in this area. A few years ago, you co-founded the mental health organization Bring Change to Mind. And as I understand it, you were motivated to do so because of your younger sister, Jessie. Could you just tell us a little bit more about her?
Yeah, my sister, Jess, she lives with bipolar disorder. And her son, Kalen, lives with schizoaffective disorder. And we really were a family that had absolutely no vocabulary for mental illness. So Jessie wasn't diagnosed until she was in her late 40s. Actually, her son was diagnosed before she was.
And what effect did this have on the family?
When Kalen got sick, none of us had dealt with anything like that before. And in our ignorance, you know, there probably were a lot of signs that he was certainly in danger of getting ill. Jessie, when I look back, when she was very little, there were certainly signs of her behavior that led, well, she tried to kill herself when she was 16, and then she tried again. And again, there was nothing that was translated in our family, as dire as that is. We were kind of spread out at the time, and I think my parents said, well, she's just, you know, a cry for help in a way, or she just has to kind of pull up her socks and get back to work and all that kind of thing. And it sounds almost hard-hearted when you talk about it now, but we were so clueless.
What do you hope that your organization will do to make things better?
I feel like I'm jumping off a very high cliff, and I have extraordinary people around me to learn from and to help me grow my wings in this whole landscape of mental illness. I still am very much learning. I'm fascinated by the challenge of actually changing people's behavior as far as mental illness is concerned, to change the discrimination and the prejudice and the stigma.
I wanted to ask you about that. How, you know, obviously this is very personal because this is within your family, but as a public figure, I'm wondering about the process you go through in deciding that you want to disclose something that is connected to you, whether it's about you or someone close to you, and whether you want to associate your name with it, particularly in the realm of mental illness. And I'm thinking about, like, the great actress Catherine Zeta-Jones disclosed recently that she suffers from bipolar disorder. And I saw an interview, and I said, where she was asked, you know, why did you decide to come out with this? And she said, well, because I was going to be outed. So she decided she was going to disclose first. But you have to wonder whether there will be impacts on her career and so forth, just because this is the world we're in. So I wanted to ask, for yourself, when you're thinking about that process as a person who's well-known, do you mind, was there any concern that might be a backlash, that people might worry about whether you are reliable, or, you know what I'm saying, or whether you even want to be associated with something that is frightening for a lot of people?
I certainly did think about that. The first call I made was to my sister, because ultimately she's the one, you know, because I wanted to have an authentic connection, and that connection is through my family. It's not just my sister. There's always been a lot of depression in my family. There's been other suicides in my family, so in other generations. And I knew that it would be, I could not do this without her at my side. Because it's about family, and it's about those in families who don't have mental illness and those that do. You know, you need both those factors. And she's my hero. The word is thrown around a lot, but she, without hesitation, said yes, that she would consent to be outed, if you will, in a national campaign. And so did her son. I never like to speak about it unless I have a family member with me. We're speaking at the International Stigma Conference up in Ottawa on June 4th. There have been certain times in my life where I've been confronted with a challenge, and my question to myself is always, what's the alternative? Not to do it because you're afraid, and you don't want to be in that position. And I'm not afraid. As an actress, I know the great power of language and of words, and if you repeat something that scares you often enough, it will lose its power over you. And so for me, that's very much the first step.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Tell Me More from NPR News. We're having a Wisdom Watch conversation with six-time Oscar nominee Glenn Close. We are talking about her advocacy on behalf of mental health. She has close family members who suffer with mental illness and are surviving with mental health, and she's talking about that and has co-founded an organization that hopes to curtail the stigma around these issues. Do you find it ironic, though, that one of the first films that kind of brought you to national attention, you know, huge hit, was Fatal Attraction, where you played a woman who is assumed, I think, to have a mental illness? Of course, you played
It's
Alex
highly
Forrest,
ironic.
And,
yeah.
And for people who don't remember, I don't know, the three people who don't, she has an affair with a married man played by Michael Douglas, and then she pursues him in a way that becomes very scary. I'll just play that short clip.
This has got to stop.
Dan, if you'd agreed to see me, I wouldn't have called you.
You get it, all right? It's over. There is nothing between us.
You mean you've had your fun, now you just want a quiet life.
Why are you doing this?
Doing what?
You need help.
I'll tell you what I need.
You need to shrink.
Why are you so hostile? I'm not your enemy.
Yeah, then why are you trying to hurt me?
I'm not trying to hurt you, Dan. I love you.
You what?
I love you.
So we were talking about the irony there. I don't know. Mm-hmm. When you think about that now, what do you think?
Well, the extraordinary thing that I think about is that I did a lot of research for to try to understand the behavior of Alex Forrest. And I gave the script to two different psychiatrists and said, is this behavior possible? And if it is, what would cause it? And neither of them came up with any mental disorder. Hmm. And that was, when was that made?
1987?
Yeah, yeah. And now that's the first thing you would think of. Since then, leaders in the field of certain illnesses have told me that it is a kind of behavior. But it's just amazing to me that the psychiatrist didn't bring it up. So what we constructed for the character had nothing to do with a mental disorder.
Well, what do you think about that now? I mean, because on the one hand, such a powerful figure. I mean, it's almost an iconic role. Do you agree? I mean, but it's always been a tough one for a lot of people. On the one hand, she's such a strong character. It's such a great role for you. On the other hand, a lot of people were, you know, always kind of disturbed by the powerful woman, and there must be something wrong with her, you know, that kind of thing.
There definitely is. There definitely is. And some people say that, and I have to be careful here because I don't want to offend anybody, but it is an extreme example, and I underline extreme example of potentially a borderline personality person.
But you're saying that
out of control.
But you're saying back then people didn't even think about the idea that there was a mental illness at work here. That's interesting.
No, well, it was interesting because I think what we came up with was that she had been incested at a very, very early age, probably pre-memory. And that can lead to all the symptoms. And that probably can be a trigger for a mental disorder later in life. That made me really empathize and love that character. But all her behavior is also kind of textbook for that phenomenon, you know, for that happening. And usually she would have killed herself. They're very, very self-destructive, absolutely no self-worth whatsoever.
One can never go back, but I do wonder if you knew then what we know now and if the cultural conversations around mental illness were what they are now, whether you would have played her differently.
You know, when they decided to change the ending and to have her, you know, become basically a psychopath and try to kill the wife, I thought it was portraying that character. I mean, it was an amazing journey for me because the audience desperately wanted catharsis. They wanted the bad seed killed off. They wanted my blood, basically, and they were given it. But I tried kind of pathetically to remind them that she was self-destructive, which, you know, the gouging my leg with a knife in that scene. I mean, you know, but it's a very, very powerful image to have somebody come after somebody else with a knife. So that's what she became.
Yeah.
I honestly don't think that that's who she was. It was brilliant for the story, and it gave the audience a sense of catharsis and that order could hopefully now be restored, which is kind of the classic thing that the shedding of blood does from Shakespeare, I mean, from the Greeks through Shakespeare, through everything. So, yeah, it was a huge learning experience for me. It would be very difficult for me to play that part now because I think it in many ways represents the kind of way my profession has perpetrated stigma and misunderstanding by making people with mental illness usually dangerous or violent and scary.
Do you feel that we're getting somewhere when it comes to these conversations and having useful conversations about this?
I think we are making progress. I think we could make much better progress. I met with a man, Norman Sartorius, who's he's considered one of the greats in that whole field of mental illness. His take on it is so fascinating because he thinks we have to ask, you know, people with mental illness, what do you need? What bothers you and what do you need? And if it's the changing of a law, then that's what we need to go for. It kind of makes sense, you know, that you have to go directly to the people. And I think many, many people do. I'm not interested in just goodwill. I want change.
Can we talk about you a little bit for the time we have left?
If you insist.
If you don't mind.
If you don't mind.
I do insist, yes. Just looking over your body of work in preparation for this conversation, I'm just continually struck by, you know, just the range of people you've played, the kinds of, you're the queen of all media, as it were, you know, you've done all these things. And just, I think many people will remember that your most recent Oscar nomination was for your 2011 film, Albert Nobbs, where you play Albert, who's actually a woman pretending to be a man so that she can work and earn a good living. And the film is set in 19th century Ireland. I just want to play a short clip from the film. This is where Albert's identity is actually revealed. I hope I'm not ruining it for people, but here it is.
That's all right.
I beg you, you won't tell on me, Mr. Page. Stop a poor woman from making a living. It would be the end of me. I don't want to finish up in the poorhouse.
Stop, Laura.
No, no.
Get him off the floor.
No, no.
Get a hold of yourself.
Talk a little bit about this, if you would, and why you were drawn to this story. You originally played this role on Broadway and then worked very hard to get the story to the big screen and 3 Oscar nominations. Not bad. Why were you so drawn to this?
As interesting it is, a question about gender, for me it was more about survival. In a time where women had absolutely no rights, and this was a woman with no name, no money, and the only way that she'd been able to work was to disguise herself as a man and be a waiter. And I think there are stories like this all over the world. Thousands of people are pretending to be something different than they are in order to survive. And I think there are people that fall between the cracks, and I think those stories should be told. I love characters that have a dream and no self-pity. And for Albert, the dream of her little tobacco shop was as big as somebody wanting to be president of the United States. You know, there's no such thing as little dreams. People have important dreams. Everybody has a story.
How have you managed to keep it so fresh all these years? You've been at it for a long time, and you find that many actors, no matter their gender, find themselves being steered in one direction or another. And you've managed to have such a range over the years. How is that?
I don't like to repeat myself. I don't like to feel redundant. And if you've dug way down into a character in a certain part of the human landscape, you've done some pretty profound work. And to do a character that would be like one that you've played, it would be boring for me, and it was very unmotivational for me. The great thing, the luxurious thing about being an actor is that you are a student of human behavior and of the human heart. It makes for a fascinating journey, and I don't want to repeat it because there's so many stories.
As I mentioned, we call this a wisdom watch, where we like to ask people if they have any wisdom to share. I hope you'll share some with us. I know, right?
Always have a dog. Dogs help.
Okay, is that it?
That's it. I would not presume to be, the wisdom is a very frightening word. Talking about frightening words. No. Somebody like Norman Sartorius, he has wisdom. Me, I still feel I'm learning. But you know what? I've always had a dog.
Well, thank you. Thank you for talking with us. I hope you'll come back and talk again about this. It's important. It's important.
Well, thank you for that, because I think we're in a day and age where old news, you know, but mental illness never should be old news.
Glenn Close is an Oscar-nominated actress and mental health advocate, and she was kind enough to join us from a bureau in New York. Glenn Close, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Thank you.
I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. In a few minutes, we are going to remember Chuck Brown. He is known as the godfather of go-go, and we'll tell you more about him in just a few minutes. But first, we are reminded time and again about the power of Mother Nature. Next week marks the 1-year anniversary of that devastating tornado that ripped through Joplin, Missouri. 161 people were killed in Joplin. Over a third of the town was destroyed. I just want to play a short clip from reporter Missy Shelton from member station KSMU. She was on the ground a year ago, and this is how she described the scene after the tornado had swept through town.
Quite frankly, as I'm talking to people, they're walking around in a daze. Even people who've lived here for years and years are having trouble finding their way around because the street signs are gone and nothing looks familiar.
The tornado destroyed Joplin High School shortly after last year's commencement ceremony, but the city has found a temporary solution to keep classes going. And next week, President Obama will be returning to Joplin High School to deliver this year's commencement speech. Here to give us an update on how Joplin High School and the town are recovering is Kerry Sacketa. He is the principal of Joplin High School. We spoke with him last year, just a few days after the tornado had hit. Welcome back, Principal Sacketa. Thanks so much for speaking with us again, and congratulations on a successful school year.
Well, thank you very much for having me. Good to talk to you again.
How are you, by the way, if you don't mind my asking? I mean, it had to be a traumatic event. And, you know, I was always impressed by how upbeat you were, even in the face of all that. But how are you doing?
I'm doing pretty good. It's been a very fast year, as we've all thought about and talked about. We've had a lot of great experiences this year. Obviously, a lot of tragedy and working with people that's emotionally and having difficult times, but people have bounced back in Joplin, and we're still bouncing back, but I'm doing fine.
The campus, as we said, was destroyed. Where have classes been held all year?
Well, we had two locations. North Park Mall here in Joplin had an empty shop that was about a 90,000 square foot store, so we put our 11th and 12th graders in that location, and that's where I'm talking to you from now. It's very nice. It was a temporary build out for 3 years, but the architects and the construction company did an outstanding job of making this what I would call a 21st century facility for kids, and people are amazed when they come here. So well, we're really proud to be able to have that, and the students have responded well. And the other half of our students, the 9th and 10th graders, are in a campus that we had in the district for quite some time that's been used for a number of things, and thankfully we had that campus for extra area for the students.
So there are ways in which the community's really stepped up, and that's a great thing, but are there things that you're still missing? Obviously the loss of life is painful, but are there other things that, you know, that just it sneaks up on you? You think, gosh, I wish it were different?
Yeah, I mean, from time to time that happens, you know. It seems like, you know, as much as you plan ahead and everybody thinks of things that they can, I lost this, I lost that. We still have a few teachers especially that are working to make their classrooms have more, I guess I should say, more items, more equipment, those kind of things. But for the most part, we're doing well. FEMA's worked with us real well. We've had so many donations. The country has been fantastic. The volunteerism, in fact, this morning I was at a coffee shop just waiting in line, and I talked to a gentleman who was here from Ohio back again a second time, and he was, you know, just wanted me to know that, you know, the rest of the country is still thinking of Joplin. They're coming in and volunteering and working with tornado relief around town, and the district itself has benefited greatly from volunteers also.
And the president is coming to deliver the commencement next week. How do people feel about that?
Oh, it's everybody's excited, especially the students, you know, and everybody around the school system. The president coming to Joplin, Missouri is very unique, like any town in the country other than a big city. So, you know, we're preparing for the president right now. In fact, we're having meetings daily with folks from his team and trying to make sure the facility is just exactly what it needs to be. And he's going to roll into our ceremony that we have planned, and he's going to be a part of that ceremony along with our governor, Governor Jay Nixon, and it'll be an outstanding night.
So what's next for next year? I know you have a big week to get through, but if we could look ahead to next year, what are you hoping for next year?
I think after we've got through this first year and we've tried desperately all year, every big event all year has been made as special as we can make it. And I think we've learned a lot from that, too. You know, sometimes when you go year after year after year and you rely on tradition a lot, and sometimes you start new traditions, and this is a year to start a lot of new traditions. I think it's made us go back and think about a lot of things that we've done. So when it comes to events for students and special activities, I think that's one lesson that we've learned. You know, hey, you know, sometimes you just need to think back and look at what you're doing and continue to build on what you've done in the past as far as those things are concerned. As far as academics are concerned, we've learned a lot this year about lesson delivery. Our teachers have worked very hard. Our kids have responded. In fact, yesterday I talked to several kids, and we're excited about 21st century learning, utilizing laptops more in the classroom, kids having more access to the world and harnessing that for good lesson delivery. And so that'll be the next thing, is continue to refine that, and so that when we move into our new facility in 2014, that's just a part of what we do, and it's a great experience for students, or it gets better every year, I should say, and we'll be excited for that. So when I guess one of the things I could say is we've started a lot of new things this year, and next year is a year to refine it, rethink about what we've done, and just make those things become better year after year after year.
Well, thanks so much for talking to us again.
Anytime.
Carrie Sicchetta is the principal at Joplin High School. That's the high school that was destroyed just after commencement ceremonies last year because of a devastating tornado that ripped through Missouri. And he was kind enough to join us by phone from his office at the temporary facility. Principal, thank you so much for speaking with us.
Thank you.
And now we turn to a different story about overcoming obstacles to get an education. Every year around this time, as students across the country don their caps and gowns and graduate from school, you tend to hear about somebody for whom that diploma really represents an achievement, somebody who really made it against the odds. This year, we want to tell you about Guts Filippi, who graduated this week with honors from Columbia University, which is also the president's alma mater. Why such a big deal? It's not just that he's 52 years old and made his way to the U.S. after fleeing civil war in the former Yugoslavia. It's also that he worked his way through school by working as a custodian at his own university. Columbia, a member of the Ivy League, makes classes available for free to employees, so he began working toward his degree back in 1993. We caught up with newly minted graduate Guts Filippi just after his commencement ceremony ended. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you very much. I'm still wearing the gown. I'm going to wear it for a while. And I look pretty well in that, to tell you the truth.
I bet you do. I bet you do. First of all, how did you find your way to Columbia?
When I arrived here in the United States, I started working as a busboy. During this time, I took English classes at a high school in the Bronx. I asked Mr. Finucane, I remember his name. He was a teacher. I asked him, which is the best university in New York? And he said, no doubt, it's Columbia University. He said, yeah, go, and you may even, he said, you may even go to college over there. I went there. I got a job in 1993.
Most people, I think, do understand that being a custodian is hard work. It's hard physical work. But your schedule was particularly grueling. You would take classes in the mornings, and then you worked the afternoon shift from 2:30 to 11 p.m., and only then could you start studying. And I just have to ask, how did you keep it going all these years? I mean, did you ever want to quit?
Yeah, it was difficult. Now I've worked from 2:30 to 11. Before, a couple of years ago, started at 4 o'clock until 12:30. And by the time I was home, it was 1 a.m., and then I would relax 15 minutes, 20 minutes. And then I would study for sometimes 2 hours, sometimes three, sometimes four, sometimes five. I can tell you this for sure, that I have not taken one midterm or one final and to be very well arrested before I took it, which is a bad thing to do. It's not good. I do not recommend nobody because I was always tired. And to come back to your question, that did I ever feel that I should quit? I did a couple of times, and the reason was that was the lack of sleep. A couple of times when the alarm clock rang, and I was so tired that I thought, you know what, let me stay, and sleep and rest and forget, this call. I'm going to drop everything. But then I found some, thank God, I found some force in me, some strength. And once I was, on my feet, then I was okay. My main concern was work, school, school, work. Work, school, school, work. That's it.
Mr. Filippo, you know, I have to ask you this. You know, when I was in college, I also worked as a custodian, and I was on scholarship. And I have to tell you, some of the other students were not always so nice about this. And sometimes it made it a little bit, you know, annoying. I mean, obviously, you had a goal in mind. But I just wondered if they ever, you know, teased you, or did you ever feel bad when you saw a student that you were sitting next to in class 1 minute studying Greek, and then the next minute you're emptying their wastebaskets. And I just wondered if you ever had feelings about that.
No, I pick up garbage, but I never, never noticed any kind of discrimination against me because of my of the job that I have been doing. Never, from no student. Never any kind of disgraceful word anybody told me ever.
Well, what are you going to do now? I understand that you were a classics major. That's not known to be the best paying field.
You're born in the United States, and you speak money first, and then everything else. It's not for me. It's not just for the money.
No, I understand your point.
And I'm not doing it for the money. But I did it more to learn the language, and at the same time, I'll learn something else more. And I'm a fan of literature a little bit, and of philosophy, and of languages also.
Well, what are you going to
do now? Does this satisfy your question? Now I'm going to try to register, and I'm going to try to go for a master's degree. Roman philosophy, that's what I'm interested in.
You've just finished your ceremony, receiving your degree. You're still in your cap and gown. Hopefully you're going to celebrate. What are you going to do to celebrate?
I'm going to... One friend who was born here in the United States and who was Columbia student, he came for commencement. So I'm going to go out with him and have some drinks. And I'm going to rest a little bit, have a couple of drinks after that again, but make sure that I do not overdo it. And then I'll go to sleep. And tomorrow I'll go to work.
Well, congratulations again.
Thank you very much.
Our very best wishes to you.
I wish you all the best also. And whoever... listen to this program.
Guts Filippi is a recent graduate of Columbia University. He earned his bachelor's degree in classics with honors. He's been working as a custodian at Columbia for nearly two decades. And finally, today we want to pause to remember the godfather of go-go, that is, Chuck Brown. He died Wednesday in Baltimore at the age of 75. His distinct take on funk music was the soundtrack of Washington, D.C. for decades. It struck a chord with fans of all ages and across genres. This past August, Chuck Brown joined us in the studio to celebrate his 75th birthday and to talk about his life and work. Here's a little bit of that conversation. So, Godfather Brown, if I can call you that.
Oh, yes.
I call you Diva. I have to call you Devo.
I didn't give myself that name. The fans and the radio stations did.
Well, yes, but of course. So, you know, Mr. Brown, I know you. It probably drives you crazy when people ask you this, but for those who don't know what go-go is, how would you describe it?
Well, it's another concept of funky music and mixed with Latin and African ingredients, percussion. And the thing about my type of music, of course, I grew up in a church, and my mother didn't allow me to sing anything but gospel at that point in time. And so as I got a little bit older and I left home, I was on my own, I wasn't interested in music no more until I was 24. And that's when I got interested in playing the guitar.
I know you mentioned that you used to only, your mom would only let you sing gospel. We have our own temple here, our tiny desk concerts, and you were nice enough to favor us with a tiny desk concert a little bit of time ago. I'll just play a little taste just to give people a sense. I know people have heard it, but just to give a little taste of Run Joe.
Run Joe. Run Joe. Run Joe. Run Joe. Policeman at the door. Run Joe. Run Joe. Run Joe. Run Joe. The police, he won't let me go.
Man got me hand. That tune come out in 1947.
Okay.
Louis Jordan. And all his kids was running around the street singing Run Joe, Run Joe. So I decided to use it, you know, put it back out my own way. And it worked.
Do you have any wisdom to share with us?
Well, I tell you, you know, God is good. Since I've been out here, I've learned so much, through experience. Things that nobody ever told me, I've learned just by, you know, being out here. And pay attention to people that listen to, people that listen to other people get wisdom. I mean, pay attention to people that are trying to teach you something. That's what I did. My kids have taught me an awful lot. They're in college, and I've learned more from them than I've learned all my lifetime.
All right. What are you going to play for us?
I love blues. You know, blues and jazz and gospel is really my thing. But first, I want to do a little bit of go-go swing. Don't be the thing if you ain't got the go-go swing. Go do-wop, 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 do-wop.
That was an excerpt of my interview this past August with the late Chuck Brown. He's called the Godfather of Go-Go, and he died yesterday in Baltimore. And we want to leave you with his big hit from 1978, Bustin' Loose. And that's our program for today. Tell Me More is produced by Bridget Armstrong, Freddie Boswell, Bridget DeShagas, Sinaj Meshkinpour, Emily Oxenschlager, Amitha Parasher, Amy Ta, and Kenya Young. Our editors are Alicia Montgomery and Ahmad Omar. Our special thanks to NPR's librarians. Our director is Arjun Hutchins. Our senior producer is Devar Ardalan. The technical director is Neil Tevolt. He had a hand this week from Sean Phillips. Our special thanks to engineering supervisor Kevin Langley. Our theme music was composed by Underdog Entertainment with additional arrangements by Ian Honeyman. The supervising senior editor is Portia Robertson-Migas. Our executive producer is Tashima Walker. And remember to tell us more, please go to npr.org and find us under the Programs tab. You can find our podcast there. You can also follow us on Facebook and Twitter at Tell Me More NPR. I'm Michelle Martin, and you've been listening to Tell Me More from NPR News and the African American Public Radio Consortium. Let's talk more tomorrow.